Acclaimed author and conservationist Peter Matheson is here. He is a recipient of the National Book Award and a laureate of the United Nations Environment Program. He's also part of an elite group of people who've been to every continent on the planet. His 29 novels and nonfiction books have brought worldwide attention to marginalized people, places, and creatures. Tonight he is back at this table to talk about his latest effort, Birds of Heaven. The book traces the migratory patterns of the world's 15 species of cranes, 11 of which are endangered. With his typical attention to detail, Peter Matheson explains why cranes are so important and what's being done to save these elegant birds. I present to you the elegant Peter Matheson. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, John.
Tell me about cranes. I mean, just look at this. Look at this.
Well, I had the great fortune to have Robert Baten as my partner in this, you know, and he's probably the best wildlife artist alive. The only one who would give him competition at all would be Lillian Forss, Lillian Forss in Sweden. And so to have him doing these paintings was an enormous asset. And also he loves cranes as well, as all wildlife people do. We call ourselves craniacs.
Craniacs. So what is it about cranes that you love?
Well, they have obvious virtues. They're the biggest of the flying birds. They are over 5 feet tall, a number of them. And they're also among the very most beautiful. And they fly great heights. That's why I use the title Birds of Heaven. They're considered a sacred bird and a near deity in some cultures. But they fly so high. Some of them really have been recorded over the Himalaya, flying over. And that's
over the Himalaya?
Over the Himalaya. That's 5 miles up there. And the special adaptations they have to have for breathing and for oxygen in there. But often they're so high that you don't see them. You just hear this extraordinary bugling, rolling. Sounds like a Chinese wood block, but this sort of roar, you know, comes out with that horn note.
Yeah.
And you think, where is that bird? You just don't see them, you know, at all. So people think they're in the heavens, and that's the title.
They're on all continents, but not South America.
Not South America, and we don't really know why not. There's probably some virus there that they can't handle. We just don't know why. They have close relatives there, but the cranes aren't there.
Yeah. And they can live up to 80 years old in
captivity. Yeah, they can. In the wild, I'm sure it's much less, but they're very long-lived birds. And a good thing, too, because, you know, their breeding rate is slow. They usually have 2 eggs, but only 1 is raised almost always. So they need longevity to make it work.
Now, where do you see them close to New York?
The closest one I've ever seen to New York was in my own village at Sagaponack, Long Island, but that was only the 3rd crane ever reported in America. We have 2 cranes here. We have, in North America, we have 2 of the 11. One is one of the rare ones, the rarest of all cranes, is the whooping crane. That's the great big white one that is only 1 migratory flock. It flies from Northwest Territories in Canada, Alberta, Wood Buffalo Park, all the way down through Canada and the United States to Aransas Island on the Gulf Coast of Texas. But when you have 1 flock like that, 1 bad storm or epidemic can finish it off. So we're making enormous efforts. When I first started writing about cranes years ago, there were only 26 alive in captivity and in the wild. That's all, 26 birds. And they had been down to 14. And all the biologists were simply writing them off. You can't bring a species back from as low as that. They are back, and there's several hundred of them, and we're now trying to establish a migratory flock between Wisconsin and West Florida and another non-migratory flock within Florida, and I think it's going to work. I think I really have very high hopes.
But how did they come back?
Well, people intervened, and the Audubon Society especially, but also Fish and Wildlife Service, and they had a tremendous education campaign in all the prairie states because the farmers in Saskatchewan and the Dakotas and Nebraska were shooting them. They get into the crop fields. And even though there's only a handful of them, they still were shot. And so they just started educating. This is a precious, beautiful, white, huge white bird. And huge is, you know, people think the great blue heron is the biggest bird around here by far. Yeah. But cranes are by far bigger than that, so it's an immense thing.
But you actually saw the one at Sagaponack?
I saw the one at Sagaponack. And in fact, he flew over my cottage where I work on the way out in the north. I don't know where he was going.
God, you must have run outside.
Because he was completely off course, you know. Yeah. But that was a sandhill crane, and that's our other species. And the sandhills are the most numerous of all the 15. In fact, if you go to the Platte River in Nebraska next month, and I recommend highly to all of your listeners.
You do that?
that you do that. You will see a half million sandhill cranes circling over the Platte River there at Kearney, Nebraska. It's a great, great sight.
I think Brokaw told me he was going to do that, or has done.
Oh, yeah, I've talked to him about that, I think. Yeah. It's a great sight. It's a great sight, and there are many blinds and a setups for doing it. And just the sound, and the, you can see them from the airplane coming in. That's one of them.
Yeah. Now, they have cultural significance, too, and religious significance.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, I think for these sort of heavenly attributes I'm talking about, that flight and that dignity and everything, all cultures have taken them up as a kind of a symbol of harmony, as a wise bird, you know, and because they're very beautiful. And they have that red crown. You know, most of the species have that bare red skin on the crown. And so that's gives them a kind of a lordly aspect, I guess. And even the Dalai Lama wrote my friend George Archibald, who's the great crane genius, the original craniac. And the Dalai Lama wrote him and said, did you know that in the Dalai Lama tradition, the black-necked crane of Tibet carries the Dalai Lamas wherever they go? And this...
is that, which one is that?
That's the red-crowned crane.
Right, the red-crowned.
That's in Japan and also in Siberia, Manchuria, down into Korea. This one, some of them, winter in the DMZ. I have a chapter in there, it's called The Accident.
In Korea.
In Korea.
Right.
If you can imagine a less likely bird sanctuary than that. The DMZ, as you know, is heavily, heavily armed and landmines.
They're opposing forces staring at each other.
Opposing forces and very hostile opposing forces. Yeah, right. Very paranoid, hostile. A lot of guns going off by accident, people tunneling under. This thing, though, happens to be 149 miles long and 7 or 8 miles wide. So you have this long string, and I call it the accidental paradise, because the cranes, birds really are not essentially very bright. They're great things to be able to fly away from problems. But
they get small brains, probably.
The brains aren't big, but they're intelligent in other ways. Yeah. But in this case, they said, here is a wonderful place, and it's practically the last undeveloped land now in South Korea, in that northern part.
And they just came there naturally.
They had been there, I guess, in the old days. There had been sun, but they chose that spot. It's exactly where the worst slaughter happened in the Korean War. It's Ice Cream Mountain and Pork Chop Hill and all those places. Is the Cholowan Valley, which is a wonderful agricultural valley, which is why the North and South Koreans were fighting over it. And there they are, in there, these two beautiful species, that one and the white-maned crane.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. Of course, it may not last.
I mean, you're such a conservationist. Mm-hmm. You know, where are you focusing your energy? Is it China? Where is it that
the cranes seem to have evolved as a group in Eastern Asia, and also I was working. You may remember a few years ago on tigers,
right.
And so I was on a tiger and crane project over there. But what I'm doing here, Charlie, is I'm trying to use the cranes as a symbol, as a metaphor for wilderness. So that if people will learn about one form of life, like a tiger or a crane, and these are spectacular, of course, animals, then they understand the biodiversity and the whole aspect of it. And virtually every human folly impinges on cranes, from warfare to polluted water to huge dams like the Three Gorges and on the Yangtze River. Everything that we do hurts them. So if we can protect them and save them some space, then maybe our children and grandchildren have some space too. They're kind of an umbrella species, we call them, because much else is protected if you protect one.
Archibald's the best friend they ever had.
He is. He's a genius. He's a genius.
Now, what's he done for them?
He's put them on the map. He began simply as a crane biologist, but he is so charming and so persuasive and so tough in a wonderful, jolly way. And he's brought these countries together. I've seen him at work at a conference where every single group hated each other. They were just snapping like glue crabs,
right.
And George comes right into it, and he's very savvy. He never stops smiling. It's wonderful to watch him. He's just terrific. And his interests are way beyond cranes. I mean, cranes for him, too. It's a way of seeing the world and getting at. This is going to be the environmental century, you know. It cannot help but be. We have to bring this resource depletion to a stop, and especially fresh water. Nobody wants to talk about fresh water.
E.O. Wilson was just here.
Yeah. Did he talk about water?
Yeah.
I'll bet he did.
And hot spots.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks about if we don't do something, that at the end of this century, it's all over.
He's right.
All over.
And nobody wants to talk about it, least of all. Well, I won't.
Politicians.
Politicians, yes. Least of all.
You know, there's no great debate going on. I mean, you know, the specifics like Anwar.
Anwar has become a symbol. I'm going to go up to Anwar this summer because I want to do something with Anwar. I've done it before. Because Anwar is really a symbol for both sides. For some reason, this administration and the oil business has made it a symbol. They want to win this one. And yet what they're winning
yeah,
is...
Yeah, but I think the Bush administration seems to me from a distance looking at them, and I'm focused more on their foreign policy than I do on their environmental policies. But it seems to me that they're hearing the message a little bit. I mean, I think they're pretty nervous about
the public reaction about
Anwar. Public reaction, right. And that the public reaction, that environmentalism has a resonance.
Yeah.
Now, it, from your standpoint, not nearly enough.
Not nearly enough.
And that has to do with how smart and strong the effort is made. In fact, that you and Neil Wilson and George Archibald and a lot of people like that, you know, have to rally people with even larger megaphones to join the cause.
That's true.
And to focus on the peril.
Right.
I mean, if you don't,
I think so.
I do think
there's a little chink in the corporate mentality now. Having been strident for years.
Yeah, you were out the front. Yes, that's right.
I'm practically the only oldest green in town. You know, and I've been out on the boonies for a long, long time.
Yes, that's right.
But, you know, and I'm pretty harsh. I mean, I'm harsh.
Yes.
I'm angry. I don't want...
You're angry at
I'm
what?
I'm angry at the heritage we're leaving our children and grandchildren. This is what American Indian people are so horrified by. How can you do that? How can you do what you do for money? I mean, for the Bush administration to say that they have to go ahead with Anwar or the like simply because they don't want to do what's bad for American business, and that's their response to the Kyoto Treaty, to the global warming. The global warming is killing us. Look at these storms and droughts. We've got a drought right now in New York.
Let me come back to the cranes because they, as you said, they are the symbol for you. Obviously, people are doing something right if they came back.
The conservationists and the bird people and the stuff they did a wonderful education campaign, and they got, and here they had international cooperation.
Yeah.
Canada was in on this, of course, too. Canada had a big role in the crane saving.
Nonfiction, Wildlife in America, The Cloud Forest, Under the Mountain Wall, The Shorebirds of North America, Salsipuedes, Blue Meridian, Blue Meridian, The Tree Where Man Was Born, The Snow Leopard, Sand Rivers, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, Indian Country. Not of all the creatures, you know, what has brought you the most satisfaction, joy, love? I mean, is it the crane? Is it the tiger? Is it the leopard? Is it what? What do you put first?
I'm fascinated by all of them. I'm still like I was when I was a little boy, collecting copperheads and stuff. My brother and I had copperheads in a hillside behind my parents' house. I'm just fascinated by what they do. I just came back from Antarctica. I love penguins, or I love the orca, or I love, but it's not that. I love, you know, if you love people, it's life, you know, it's an embrace of life. So I'm fascinated by Gila monsters and ugly snakes and stuff too, you know, it's so-called.
So it's
ugly.
Not just beauty, it's
not
just
ugly
the
majesty.
It's not just the majesty of them, it is, these are living creatures.
These are living creatures who are doing fascinating things and have their own intelligence. It's not our kind of intelligence, but they have intelligences which we've lost, I think, you know.
Like what?
Well, for example, speed and dexterity of movement and stuff like that. There's not an animal alive that can't outrun us. Most of them are much, much stronger for their size and so forth. They are physically much, much more powerful and much more adaptable and tougher. They're things that they understand, and also their migrations. We have no clue. We do not know how green turtles migrate, or birds migrate, or how young birds left behind in the Arctic by their parents. The parents fly south. They have their nest, get the chicks up, and then they take off. Chicks can't even fly yet. But when they do fly, where do they fly? They fly where they're supposed to fly. That distance, thousands of miles.
Explain that to me.
I can't. How can I explain it to you? No one's explained it to me.
But no one.
No one.
Understands how they can do that.
They know that they're very gifted magnetically. Yeah. They have all sorts of...
Well, it's in the genes is all we can say. It's in the genes.
Believe you me, the RR services, the Navy and people like that, they are studying.
Fascinated by it.
Oh, of course they are.
What's the most beautiful place for you?
just at the moment, because I was stunned by it and taken by surprise, I think Antarctica.
Really?
Antarctica. But part of the beauty is that absolute spare, clean, pristine, silent. There's no sound down there and nothing. There's quite a lot of life, actually. But, you know, I thought the Antarctic was like the Arctic. I thought it was just sort of a flat white waste. It's not. It's the 12,000, 14,000 feet peaks. These extraordinary white mountains coming right down to the blue water and the penguins and all the stuff that's there. You know, it's wild.
You know, you're a kid at heart, my friend.
I am.
Is there a documentary to be made about cranes? Or has
there have been a number of small films made. I think they could make a wonderful one on cranes. And maybe putting together a lot of the stuff that exists. This thing called Blue Planet that's on Discovery is wonderful
really?
Stuff. That's David Attenborough.
Oh, it's great. It is. Oh, the Attenborough stuff is really. Fabulous.
Yeah. And I'd love to see something of the kind done with birds because, you know.
Cranes are ubiquitous in the early legends of the world's peoples where they often figure as sentinels of heaven and omens of longevity and good fortune. For their great beauty and imposing sign, they are the largest of all flying birds on Earth. They are held near sacred in many lands. Their broad wilderness habitat requirement makes them umbrella species. Protecting them ensures that other creatures in the earth and water of the ecosystem are protected. In addition, the enormous span of cranes' migrations have encouraged international conservation efforts. Peter Matheson, The Birds of Heaven. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Pleasure. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.